Chapter 12. The Internet of Surveillance. A few years ago, nobody cared about the thermostat in your home. It was a simple manually operated thermostat that kept your home at a comfortable temperature. Then thermostats became programmable. And then a company, Nest, decided that you should be able to control your programmable thermostat with an internet-based app. You can sense where I'm going with this, right? In one vengeful product review of the Honeywell Wi-Fi smart touchscreen thermostat, someone who calls himself the General wrote on Amazon that his ex-wife took the house, the dog, and the 401k, but he retained the password to the Honeywell thermostat. When the ex-wife and her boyfriend were out of town, the General claimed he would jack up the temperature in the house and then lower it back down before they returned. I can only imagine what their electricity bills might be. It makes me smile. Researchers at Black Hat USA 2014, a conference for people in the information security industry, revealed a few ways in which the firmware of a Nest thermostat could be compromised. It is important to note that many of these compromises require physical access to the device, meaning that someone would have to get inside your house and install a USB port on the thermostat. Daniel Buentello, an independent security researcher, one of four presenters who talked about hacking the device, said, "This is a computer that the user can't put an antivirus on. Worse yet, there's a secret back door that a bad person could use and stay there forever. It's a literal fly on the wall." The team of researchers showed a video in which they changed the Nest thermostat interface. They made it look like the HAL 9000 fishbowl camera lens and uploaded various other new features. Interestingly, they were not able to turn off the automatic reporting feature within the device, so the team produced their own tool to do so. This tool would cut off the stream of data flowing back to Google, the parent company of Nest. Commenting on the presentation, Zaz Kuchias of Nest later told VentureBeat, "All hardware devices from laptops to smartphones are susceptible to jailbreaking. This is not a unique problem. This is a physical jailbreak requiring physical access to the Nest Learning Thermostat. If someone managed to get in your home and had their choice, chances are they would install their own devices or take the jewelry. This jailbreak doesn't compromise the security of our servers or the connections to them, and to the best of our knowledge, no devices have been accessed and compromised remotely. Customer security is very important to us, and our highest priority is on remote vulnerabilities. One of your best defenses is to buy a DropCam Pro so you can monitor your home when you're not there." With the advent of the Internet of Things, companies like Google are eager to colonize parts of it, to own the platforms that other products will use. In other words, these companies want devices developed by other companies to connect to their services and not someone else's. Google owns both DropCam and Nest, but they want other Internet of Things devices, such as smart light bulbs and baby monitors, to connect to your Google account as well. The advantage of this, at least to Google, is that they get to collect more raw data about your personal habits. And this applies to any large company, Apple, Samsung, even Honeywell. In talking about the Internet of Things, computer security expert Bruce Schneier concluded in an interview, "This is very much like the computer field in the 90s. No one's paying any attention to security. No one's doing updates. No one knows anything. It's all really, really bad, and it's going to come crashing down. There will be vulnerabilities. They'll be exploited by bad guys, and there will be no way to patch them." To prove that point, in the summer of 2013, journalist Kashmir Hill did some investigative reporting and found some DIY computer hacking. By using a Google search, she found a simple phrase that allowed her to control some Insteon hub devices for the home. A hub is a central device that provides access to a mobile app or to the internet directly. Through the app, people can control the lighting in their living rooms, lock the doors to their houses, or adjust the temperature of their homes. Through the internet, the owner can adjust these things while, say, on a business trip. As Hill showed, an attacker could also use the internet to remotely contact the hub. As further proof, she reached out to Thomas Hatley, a complete stranger in Oregon, and asked if she could use his home as a test case. From her home in San Francisco, Hill was able to turn on and off the lights within Hatley's home, some 600 miles up the Pacific coast. She could also have controlled his hot tubs, fans, televisions, water pumps, garage doors, and video surveillance cameras if he had had those connected. The problem, now corrected, was that Insteon made all Hatley's information available on Google. Worse, access to this information wasn't protected by a password at the time. Anyone who stumbled upon this fact could control any Insteon hub that could be found online. Hatley's router did have a password, but that could be bypassed by looking for the port used by Insteon, which is what Hill did. Thomas Hatley's home was one of eight that I was able to access, Hill wrote. Sensitive information was revealed, not just what appliances and devices people had, but their time zone, along with the closest major city to their home, IP addresses, and even the name of a child. Apparently, the parents wanted the ability to pull the plug on his television from afar. In at least three cases, there was enough information to link the homes on the internet to their locations in the real world. The names for most of the systems were generic, but in one of those cases, it included a street address that I was able to track down to a house in Connecticut. Around the same time, a similar problem was found by Nitesh Dhanjani, a security researcher. Dhanjani was looking, in particular, at the Philips Hue lighting system, which allows the owner to adjust the color and brightness of a light bulb from a mobile device. The bulb has a range of 16 million colors. Dhanjani found that a simple script inserted onto a home computer on the home network was enough to cause a denial-of-service attack on the lighting system. In other words, he could make any room with a Hue light bulb go dark at will. What he scripted was a simple code so that when the user restarted the bulb, it would quickly go out again and would keep going out as long as the code was present. Dhanjani said that this could spell serious trouble for an office building or apartment building. The code would render all the lights inoperable, and the people affected would call the local utility, only to find there was no power outage in their area. The outage was caused remotely via a computer script. Computer scripts can affect other smart home systems. If you have a newborn in your home, you may also have a baby monitor. This device, either a microphone or a camera, or a combination of both, allows parents to be out of the nursery but still keep track of their baby. Unfortunately, these devices can invite others to observe the child as well. Analog baby monitors use retired wireless frequencies in the 43 to 50 megahertz range. These frequencies were first used for cordless phones in the 1990s, and anyone with a cheap radio scanner could easily intercept cordless phone calls without the target ever knowing what happened. Even today, a hacker could use a spectrum analyzer to discover the frequency that a particular analog baby monitor uses, then employ various demodulation schemes to convert the electrical signal to audio. A police scanner from an electronics store would also suffice. There have been numerous legal cases in which neighbors using the same brand of baby monitor set to the same channel eavesdropped on one another. In 2009, Wes Denkov of Chicago sued the manufacturers of the Summer Infant Day and Night Baby Video Monitor, claiming that his neighbor could hear private conversations held in his home. As a countermeasure, you might want to use a digital baby monitor. These are still vulnerable to eavesdropping, but they have better security and more configuration options. For example, you can update the monitor's firmware, the software on the chip, immediately after purchase. Also, be sure to change the default username and password. Here again, you might come up against a design choice that is out of your control. Nitesh Dhanjani found that the Belkin Wemo wireless baby monitor uses a token in an app that, once installed on your mobile device and used on your home network, remains active from anywhere in the world. Say you agree to babysit your newborn niece and your brother invites you to download the Belkin app to your phone through his local home network. With any luck, it is protected with a WPA2 password. Now, you have access to your brother's baby monitor from across the country, from across the globe. Donjani notes that this design flaw is present in many interconnected Internet of Things devices. Basically, these devices assume that everything on the local network is trusted. If, as some believe, we'll all have 20 or 30 such devices in our homes before long, the security model will have to change. Since everything on the network is trusted, then a flaw in any one device, your baby monitor, your light bulb, your thermostat, could allow a remote attacker onto your smart home network and give him an opportunity to learn even more about your personal habits. Long before mobile apps, there were handheld remotes. Most of us are too young to remember the days before TVs had remote controls, the days when people had to physically get up off the couch and turn a dial to change the channel or to pump up the volume. Today, from the comfort of our sofas, we can just instruct the TV with our words. That may be very convenient, but it also means that the TV is listening, if only for the command to turn itself on. In the early days, remote controls for TVs required direct line of sight and functioned by using light, specifically infrared technology. A battery-operated remote would emit a sequence of flashes of lights barely visible to the human eye, but visible, again within a line of sight, to a receptor on the TV. How would the TV know if you wanted to turn it on when it was off? Simple. The infrared sensor located within the TV was always on standby, waiting for a particular sequence of infrared light pulses from the handheld remote to wake it up. Remote-controlled TVs evolved over the years to include wireless signals, which meant you didn't have to stand directly in front of the TV. You could be off to one side, sometimes even in another room. Again, the TV was on in standby mode, waiting for the proper signal to wake it up. Fast forward to voice-activated TVs. These TVs do away with the remote you hold in your hand, which if you're like me, you can never find when you want it anyway. Instead, you say something silly like, TV on, or hi TV, and the TV, magically, turns on. In the spring of 2015, security researchers Ken Munro and David Lodge wanted to see whether voice-activated Samsung TVs were listening in on conversations in the room even when the TV was not in use. While they found that digital TVs do in fact sit idle when they are turned off, which is reassuring, the TVs record everything spoken after you give them a simple command, such as hi TV. That is, they record everything until the TV is commanded to turn off again. How many of us will remember to keep absolutely quiet while the TV is on? We won't. And to make matters even more disturbing, what we say and what is recorded after the hi TV command is not encrypted. If I can get on your home network, I can eavesdrop on whatever conversation you're having in your home while the TV is turned on. The argument in favor of keeping the TV in listening mode is that the device needs to hear any additional commands you might give it, such as volume up, change the channel, and mute the sound. That might be okay, except the captured voice commands go up to a satellite before they come back down again. And because the entire string of data is not encrypted, I can carry out a man-in-the-middle attack on your TV, inserting my own commands to change your channel, pump up your volume, or simply turn off the TV whenever I want. Let's think about that for a second. That means if you're in a room with a voice-activated TV in the middle of a conversation with someone, and you decide to turn on the TV, the stream of conversation that follows may be recorded by your digital TV. Moreover, that recorded conversation about the upcoming bake sale at the elementary school may be streamed back to a server somewhere far from your living room. In fact, Samsung streams that data not only to itself, but also to another company called Nuance, a voice recognition software company. That's two companies that have vital information about the upcoming bake sale. And let's get real here. The average conversation you're having in your TV room probably isn't about a bake sale. Maybe you're talking about something illegal, which law enforcement might want to know about. It is entirely likely that these companies would inform law enforcement, but if law enforcement, for example, were already interested in you, then officers might get a warrant forcing these companies to provide complete transcripts. Sorry, but it was your smart TV that narked on you. Samsung has, in its defense, stated that such eavesdropping scenarios are mentioned in the privacy agreements that all users implicitly agree to when they turn on the TV. But when was the last time you read a privacy agreement before turning on a device for the first time? Samsung says in the near future, all its TV communications will be encrypted, but as of 2015, most models on the market are not protected. Fortunately, there are ways to disable this HAL 9000-like feature on your Samsung and presumably on other manufacturers' TVs as well. On the Samsung PN60 F8500 and similar products, go into the Settings menu, select Smart Features, and then under Voice Recognition, select Off. But if you want to stop your TV from being able to record sensitive conversations in your home, you'll have to sacrifice being able to walk into a room and voice command your TV to turn on. You can still, with remote in hand, select the microphone button and speak your commands, or you could get up off the couch and switch the channels yourself. I know, life is hard. Unencrypted data streams are not unique to Samsung. While testing LG smart TVs, a researcher found that data is being sent back to LG over the internet every time the viewer changes the channel. The TV also has a settings option called Collection of Watching Info, enabled by default. Your watching info includes the names of files stored on any USB drive you connect to your LG television, say one that contains photos from your family vacation. Researchers carried out another experiment in which they created a mock video file and loaded it to a USB drive, then plugged it into their TV. When they analyzed network traffic, they found that the video file name was transmitted, unencrypted, within HTTP traffic and sent to the address gb.smartshare.lgtvsdp.com. Sensory, a company that makes embedded speech recognition solutions for smart products, thinks it can do even more. "We think the magic in smart TVs is to leave it always on and always listening," says Todd Moser, CEO of Sensory. "Right now, listening consumes too much power to do that. Samsung's done a really intelligent thing and created a listening mode. We want to go beyond that and make it always on, always listening, no matter where you are." Now that you know what your digital TV is capable of, you might be wondering, can your cell phone eavesdrop when it's turned off? There are three camps: yes, no, and it depends. There are those in the privacy community who swear you have to take the battery out of your turned-off smartphone to be sure that it is not listening. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence to support this. It's mostly anecdotal. Then there are the people who swear that just turning off your phone is good enough. Case closed. But I think in reality there are instances, say if malware is added to a smartphone, when it doesn't turn off entirely and could still record conversations held nearby. So, it depends on a variety of factors. There are some phones that wake up when you say a magic phrase, just as voice-activated TVs do. This would imply that the phones are listening at all times, waiting for the magic phrase. This would also imply that what is said is somehow being recorded or transmitted. In some malware-infected phones, that is true. The phone's camera or microphone is activated when there is not a call in progress. These cases, I think, are rare. But back to the main question. There are some in the privacy community who swear that you can activate a phone when it is turned off. There is malware that can make the phone appear to be off when it is not. However, the possibility that someone could activate a turned-off phone, no battery power, strikes me as impossible. Basically, any device that has battery power that allows its software to be in a running state can be exploited. It's not hard for a firmware backdoor to make the device appear that it's off when it isn't. A device with no power can't do anything. Or can it? Some still argue that the NSA has put chips in our phones that provide power and allow tracking even when the phone is physically powered off, even if the physical battery is pulled. Whether or not your phone is capable of listening, the browser you use on it certainly is. Around 2013, Google started what's called hot wording, a feature that allows you to give a simple command that activates the listening mode in Chrome. Others have followed suit, including Apple's Siri, Microsoft's Cortana, and Amazon's Alexa. So your phone, your traditional PC, and that standalone device on your coffee table all contain back-end in-the-cloud services that are designed to respond to voice commands such as, Siri, how far to the nearest gas station? Which means they listen. And if that doesn't concern you, know that the searches conducted by these services are recorded and saved indefinitely. Indefinitely. So how much do these devices hear? Actually, it's a little unclear what they do when they are not answering questions or turning your TV on and off. For example, using the traditional PC version of the Chrome browser, researchers found that someone, Google, appeared to be listening all the time by enabling the microphone. This feature came to Chrome from its open source equivalent, a browser known as Chromium. In 2015, researchers discovered that someone, Google, appeared to be listening all the time. Upon further investigation, they discovered that this is because the browser turns the microphone on by default. Despite being included in open source software, this code was not available for inspection. There are several problems with this. First, open source means that people should be able to look at the code. But in this case, the code was a black box, code that no one had vetted. Second, this code made its way to the popular version of the browser via an automatic update from Google, which users weren't given a chance to refuse. And as of 2015, Google has not removed it. They did offer a means for people to opt out, but that opt-out requires coding skills so complicated that average users can't do it on their own. There are other, more low-tech ways to mitigate this creepy eavesdropping feature in Chrome and other programs. For the webcam, simply put a piece of tape over it. For the microphone, one of the best defenses is to put a dummy mic plug in the microphone socket of your traditional PC. To do this, get an old, broken set of headphones or earbuds and simply cut the wire near the microphone jack. Now plug that stub of a mic jack into the socket. Your computer will think there's a microphone there when there isn't. Of course, if you want to make a call using Skype or some other online service, then you will need to remove the plug first. Also, and this is very important, make sure the two wires on the mic stub do not touch so that you don't fry your microphone port. Another connected device that lives in the home is the Amazon Echo, an internet hub that allows users to order movies on demand and other products from Amazon just by speaking. The Echo is also always on, in standby mode, listening to every word, waiting for the wake word. Because Amazon Echo does more than a smart TV does, it requires first-time users to speak up to 25 specific phrases into the device before they give it any commands. Amazon can tell you the weather outside, provide the latest sports scores, and order or reorder items from its collection if you ask it to. Given the generic nature of some of the phrases Amazon recognizes, for example, will it rain tomorrow, it stands to reason that your Echo might be listening more than your smart TV is. Fortunately, Amazon provides ways to remove your voice data from Echo. If you want to delete everything, for example, if you plan to sell your Echo to another party, then you need to go online to do that. While all these voice-activated devices require a specific phrase to wake up, it remains unclear what each device is doing during downtime, the time when no one is commanding it to do anything. When possible, turn off the voice activation feature in the configuration settings. You can always turn it back on again when you need it. Joining the Amazon Echo in the Internet of Things, in addition to your TV and thermostat, is your refrigerator. Refrigerator? Samsung has announced a model of refrigerator that connects with your Google Calendar to display upcoming events on a flat screen embedded in the appliance's door, kind of like that whiteboard you once had in its place, only now the refrigerator connects to the internet through your Google account. Samsung did several things right in designing this smart fridge. They included an SSL HTTPS connection so traffic between the refrigerator and the Google Calendar server is encrypted. And they submitted their futuristic refrigerator for testing at DEF CON 23, one of the most intense hacker conventions on Earth. But according to security researchers Ken Monroe and David Lodge, the individuals who hacked the digital TV communications, Samsung failed to check the certificate to communicate with Google servers and obtain Gmail calendar information. A certificate would validate that the communications between the refrigerator and the Google servers are secure, but without it, someone with malicious intent could come along and create his own certificate, allowing him to eavesdrop on the connection between your refrigerator and Google. So what? Well, in this case, by being on your home network, someone could not only gain access to your refrigerator and spoil your milk and eggs, but also gain access to your Google account information by performing a man-in-the-middle attack on the fridge calendar client and stealing your Google login credentials, allowing him or her to read your Gmail and perhaps do even greater damage. Smart refrigerators are not the norm yet, but it stands to reason that as we connect more devices to the internet, and even to our home networks, there will be lapses in security, which is frightening, especially when the thing being compromised is something really precious and private, like your home. Internet of Things companies are working on apps that will turn any device into a home security system. Your TV, for instance, might someday contain a camera. In that scenario, an app on a smartphone or tablet could allow you to view any room in your home or office from any remote location. Lights, too, can be turned on when there is motion inside or outside the house. In one scenario, you might drive up to your house, and as you do so, the alarm system app on your phone or in your car uses its built-in geolocation capabilities to sense your arrival. When you're 50 feet away, the app signals the home alarm system to unlock the front or garage door. The app on your phone is already connected to the house and authenticated. The alarm system further contacts the in-home lighting system, asking it to illuminate the porch, entryway, and maybe either the living room or kitchen. Additionally, you may want to enter your home while soft chamber music or the latest top 40 tune from a service such as Spotify is playing on the stereo. And, of course, the temperature of the house warms or cools according to the season and your preferences now that you are home again. Home alarms became popular around the turn of the 21st century. Home alarm systems at that time required a technician to mount wired sensors in the doors and windows of the house. These wired sensors were connected to a central hub that used a wired landline to send and receive messages from the monitoring service. You would set the alarm, and if anyone compromised the secured doors and windows, the monitoring service would contact you, usually by phone. A battery was often provided in case the power went out. Note that a landline usually never loses power unless the wire to the house is cut. When a lot of people got rid of their copper wire landlines and relied solely upon their mobile communication services, the alarm monitoring companies began offering cellular-based connections. Lately, they've switched to internet-based app services. The alarm sensors on the doors and windows themselves are now wireless. There is certainly less drilling and stringing of ugly cable, but there is also more risk. Researchers have repeatedly found that the signals from these wireless sensors are not encrypted. A would-be attacker need only listen to the communications between devices in order to compromise them. For example, if I can breach your local network, I can eavesdrop on the communications between your alarm company's servers and your in-home device, assuming it's on the same local network and not encrypted. And by manipulating those communications, I can start to control your smart home, spoofing commands to control the system. Companies are now providing do-it-yourself home monitoring services. If any sensors are disturbed, your cell phone lights up with a text message informing you of the change. Or perhaps the app provides a webcam image from inside the house. Either way, you are in control and are monitoring the house yourself. That's great, until your home internet goes out. Even when the internet is working, the bad guys can still subvert or suppress these do-it-yourself wireless alarm systems. For example, an attacker can trigger false alarms, which in some cities, the homeowner has to pay for. Devices that create false alarms could be set off from the street in front of your house or up to 250 yards away. Too many false alarms could render the system unreliable and the homeowner out of pocket for a hefty fee. Or the attacker could jam the do-it-yourself wireless sensor signals by sending radio noise to prevent communication back to the main hub or control panel. It suppresses the alarm and prevents it from sounding, effectively neutralizing the protection and allowing the criminal to walk right in. A lot of people have installed webcams in their homes, whether for security, for monitoring a cleaning person or nanny, or for keeping tabs on a homebound senior or loved one with special needs. Unfortunately, a lot of these over-the-internet webcams are vulnerable to remote attacks. There's a publicly available web search engine known as Shodan that exposes non-traditional devices configured to connect to the internet. Shodan displays results not only from your Internet of Things devices at home, but also from internal municipal utilities networks and industrial control systems that have been misconfigured to connect their servers to the public network. It also displays data streams from countless misconfigured commercial webcams all over the world. It has been estimated that on any given day there may be as many as 100,000 webcams with little or no security transmitting over the internet. Among these are internet cameras without default authentication from a company called D-Link, which can be used to spy on people in their private moments, depending on what these cameras are set to capture. An attacker can use Google filters to search for D-Link internet cameras. The attacker can then look for the models that default to no authentication, then go to a website such as Shodan, click a link, and view the video streams at his leisure. To help prevent this, keep your internet-accessible webcams turned off when they're not in use. Physically disconnect them to be sure they're off. When they are in use, make sure they have proper authentication and are set to a strong, customized password, not the default one. If you think your home is a privacy nightmare, wait until you see your workplace. I'll explain in the next chapter. Chapter 13. Things Your Boss Doesn't Want You to Know. If you've read this far, you're obviously concerned about privacy, but for most of us, it's not a matter of hiding from the federal government. Rather, we know that when we're at work, our employers can see exactly what we're doing online over their networks, e.g. shopping, playing games, goofing off. A lot of us just want to cover our asses. And that's getting harder to do, thanks in part to the cell phones we carry. Whenever Jane Rogers, finance manager of a Chicago landscaping company, wants to know whether her employees in the field are where they should be, she pulls up their exact locations on her laptop. Like many managers and company owners, she is turning to tracking software on corporate-owned, personally-enabled, COPE, smartphones, and service trucks with GPS devices to surveil her employees. One day, a customer asked Jane whether one of her landscapers had been out to perform a service. After a few keystrokes, Jane verified that between 10 o'clock a.m. and 10:30 a.m., one of her employees had been to the specified place. The telematics service Rogers uses provides capabilities beyond geolocation. For example, on her 9 company-owned phones, she can also view photos, text messages, and emails sent by her gardeners. She also has access to their call logs and website visits, but Rogers says she only uses the GPS feature. GPS tracking in the service industry has been available for a long time. It, along with United Parcel Service's own Orion system of algorithmic route selection, has allowed the package delivery company to cut down on gas expenses by monitoring and suggesting optimized routes for its drivers. The company was also able to crack down on lazy drivers. In these ways, UPS has increased its volume by 1.4 million additional packages per day, with 1,000 fewer drivers. All this is good for the employers, who argue that by squeezing out higher margins, they can in turn afford to pay better wages. But how do employees feel? There is a downside to all this surveillance. In an analysis, Harper's Magazine featured a profile of a driver who was electronically monitored while at work. The driver, who did not give his name, said that the software timed his deliveries to the second and informed him whenever he was under or over optimal time. At the end of a typical day, the driver said he might be over by as much as 4 hours. Slacking off? The driver pointed out that a single stop might include multiple packages, which the Orion software does not always account for. The driver described co-workers in his New York distribution center who were battling chronic pain in their lower backs and knees from trying to carry too much in a single trip, despite constant reminders from the company regarding proper handling of heavy loads, in order to keep up with the software. So, there's one kind of human cost to this employee monitoring. Another place where work surveillance is used regularly is the food service industry. From cameras in the ceilings of restaurants to kiosks at the tabletop, wait staff can be watched and rated by various software systems. A 2013 study by researchers from Washington University, Brigham Young University, and MIT found that theft monitoring software used in 392 restaurants produced a 22% reduction in server-side financial theft after it was installed. As I mentioned, actively monitoring people does change their behavior. There are currently no federal statutes in the United States to prohibit companies from tracking their employees. Only Delaware and Connecticut require employers to tell employees when they are being tracked. In most states, employees have no idea whether they are being watched at work. What about the employees in the office? The American Management Association found that 66% of employers monitor the internet use of their employees. 45% track employee keystrokes at the computer, noting idle time as potential breaks, and 43% monitor the contents of employee email. Some companies monitor employees' Outlook calendar entries, email headers, and instant messaging logs. The data is ostensibly used to help companies figure out how their employees are spending their time, from how much time salespeople are spending with customers to which divisions of the company are staying in touch by email to how much time employees are spending in meetings or away from their desks. Of course, there's a positive spin. Having such metrics means that the company can be more efficient in scheduling meetings or in encouraging teams to have more contact with each other. But the bottom line is that someone is collecting all this corporate data, and it could someday be turned over to law enforcement, or at the very least, used against you in a performance review. You are not invisible at work. Anything passing through a corporate network belongs to the company. It is not yours. Even if you are checking your personal email account, your last order with Amazon, or planning a vacation, you are probably using a company-issued phone, laptop, or VPN. So, expect to have someone monitoring everything you do. Here's an easy way to keep your manager and even your coworkers from snooping when you leave your desk to go to a meeting or the bathroom. Lock your computer screen. Seriously. Don't leave your email or details about the project you've spent weeks on open, just sitting there for someone to mess with. Lock your computer until you return to your screen. It takes a few extra seconds, but it'll spare you a lot of grief. Set a timer in the operating system to lock the screen after a certain number of seconds. Or look into one of the Bluetooth apps that will automatically lock your screen if your mobile phone is not near the computer. That said, there is a new attack that uses a weaponized USB device. A lot of offices seal the USB ports on their laptops and desktops, but if yours doesn't, a weaponized USB stick could still unlock your computer without a password. In addition to corporate secrets, there's also a fair amount of personal email that passes through our computers during the workday. And sometimes we print it out for ourselves while in the office. If you are concerned about privacy, don't do anything personal while at work. Keep a strict firewall between your work life and your home life. Or bring a personal device, such as a laptop or an iPad, from home if you feel the need to do personal stuff while on break. And if your mobile device is cellular enabled, never use the company Wi-Fi, and further, turn off the SSID broadcast if you are using a portable hotspot. Only use cellular data when conducting personal business
at work. Really, once you arrive at your office, your public game face needs to be on. Just as you wouldn't talk about really personal things with your casual office mates, you need to keep your personal business off the company's computer systems, especially when you're searching for health-related topics or looking for a new job. It's harder than it sounds. For one thing, we're used to the ubiquity of information and the nearly universal availability of the internet. But if you are going to master the art of invisibility, you have to prevent yourself from doing private things in public. Assume that everything you type into your office computer is public. That doesn't mean that your IT department is actively monitoring your particular device or will ever act on the fact that you printed out your child's science fair project on the expensive color printer on the fifth floor. Although they might. The point is, there's a record that you did these things. And should there be suspicion in the future, they can access the records of everything you did on that machine. It's their machine, not yours. And it's their network. That means they're scanning the content that flows in and out of the company. Consider the case of Adam, who downloaded his free credit report on his work computer. He logged into the credit bureau site using the company computer over the company network. Let's say you, like Adam, also download your credit report at work. You want to print it out, right? So, why not send it to the company printer over in the corner? Because if you do, there will be a copy of the PDF file containing your credit history sitting on the hard drive of the printer. You don't control the printer. And after the printer is retired and removed from the office, you don't have control over how that hard drive is disposed of. Some printers are now encrypting their drives, but can you be sure that the printer in your office is encrypted? You can't. That's not all. Every Word or Excel document that you create using Microsoft Office includes metadata that describes the document. Typically, document metadata includes the author's name, the date created, the number of revisions, and the file size, as well as an option to add more details. This is not enabled by default by Microsoft. You have to go through some hoops to see it. Microsoft has, however, included a document inspector that can remove these details before you export the document elsewhere. A 2012 study sponsored by Xerox and McAfee found that 54% of employees say they don't always follow their company's IT security policies, and 51% of employees whose workplace has a printer, copier, or multifunction printer say they've copied, scanned, or printed confidential personal information at work. And it's not just work. The same goes for printers at the local copy shop and the local library. They all contain hard drives that remember everything they've printed over their lifetimes. If you need something personal printed out, perhaps you should print it out later at home on a network and printer over which you have control. Spying, even on employees, has gotten very creative. Some companies enlist non-traditional office devices that we might otherwise take for granted, never imagining that they could be used to spy on us. Consider the story of a young Columbia University graduate student named Ang Kui. Wondering if he could hack into a corporate office and steal sensitive data through non-traditional means, Kui decided first to attack laser printers, a staple in most offices today. Kui noted that printers were way behind the times. During several pen tests, I have observed this as well. I have been able to leverage the printer to get further access into the corporate network. This is because workers rarely change the admin password on printers that are internally deployed. The software and the firmware used in printers, especially commercial printers for the home office, contain a lot of basic security flaws. The thing is, very few people see an office printer as vulnerable. They think they're enjoying what's sometimes called security by obscurity. If no one notices the flaw, then you are safe. But as I've said, printers and copy machines, depending on the model, have one important thing in common. They both may contain hard drives, and unless that hard drive is encrypted, and many are still not, it is possible to access what has been printed at a later date. All this has been known for years. What Kui wondered was if he could turn a company printer against its owners and exfiltrate whatever was printed. To make things more interesting, Kui wanted to attack the printer's firmware code. the programming embedded inside a chip within the printer. Unlike our traditional PCs and mobile devices, digital TVs and other smart electronics do not have the power or the processing resources to run a full-blown operating system, such as Android, Windows, and iOS. Instead, these devices use what's called real-time operating systems, RTOS, which are stored on individual chips inside the device, frequently known as fireware. These chips store only the commands needed to operate the system and not much else. Occasionally, even these simple commands need to be updated by the manufacturer or vendor by flashing or replacing the chips. Given that this is done so infrequently, it's obvious that many manufacturers simply did not build in the proper security measures. This, the lack of update, was the vector that Cui decided to pursue for his attack. Cui wanted to see what would happen if he hacked the file format HP used for its firmware updates, and he discovered that HP didn't check the validity of each update. So, he created printer firmware of his own, and the printer accepted it. Just like that. There was no authentication on the printer's side that the update came from HP. The printer only cared that the code was in the expected format. Cui was now free to explore. In one famous experiment, Cui reported that he could turn on the fuser bar, the part of the printer that heats the paper after the ink has been applied, and leave it on, which would cause the printer to catch fire. The vendor, not HP, immediately responded by arguing that there was a thermo failsafe within the fuser bar, meaning the printer could not overheat. However, that was Cui's point. He'd managed to turn that failsafe feature off so that the machine could actually catch fire. As a result of these experiments, Cui and his advisor, Salvatore Stolfo, argued that printers were weak links in any organization or home. For example, the HR department of a Fortune 500 company might receive a maliciously coded resume file over the internet. In the time it takes the hiring manager to print that document, the printer through which it travels could be fully compromised by installing a malicious version of the firmware. Preventing someone from grabbing your documents off the printer, secure printing, also known as pull printing, ensures the documents are only released upon a user's authentication at the printer. Usually a passcode must be entered before the document will print. This can be done by using a PIN, smart card, or biometric fingerprint. Pull printing also eliminates unclaimed documents, preventing sensitive information from lying around for everyone to see. Building on his printer attacks, Cui began to look around the typical office for other common objects that might be vulnerable and settled on Voice over Internet Protocol, VOIP telephones. As with printers, no one had appreciated the hidden yet obvious once-you-thought-about-it value of these devices in collecting information, and as with a printer, an update to the system can be faked and accepted by the VOIP phone. Most VOIP phones have a hands-free option that allows you to put someone on speakerphone in your cubicle or office, which means there's not only a speaker, but also a microphone on the outside of the handset. There's also an off-the-hook switch, which tells the phone when someone has picked up the receiver and wants to make or listen to a call, as well as when the receiver has been put back and the speakerphone is enabled. We realized that if he could compromise the off-the-hook switch, he could make the phone listen to conversations nearby via the speakerphone microphone, even when the receiver was on the hook. One caveat. Unlike a printer, which can receive malicious code via the internet, VOIP phones need to be updated individually by hand. This requires the code to be propagated using a USB drive. Not a problem, Cui decided. For a price, a night janitor could install the code on each phone with a USB stick as he or she cleaned the office. Cui has presented this research at a number of conferences, each time using different VOIP telephones. And each time, the vendor was notified in advance, and each time, the vendor did produce a fix. But Cui has pointed out that just because a patch exists doesn't mean it gets applied. Some of the unpatched phones might still be sitting in offices, hotels, and hospitals right now. So, how did Cui get the data off the phone? Since office computer networks are monitored for unusual activity, he needed another means of extracting the data. He decided to go off-network and use radio waves instead. Previously, researchers at Stanford University and in Israel found that having your mobile phone positioned next to your computer can allow a remote third party to eavesdrop on your conversations. The trick requires malware to be inserted onto your mobile device, but with maliciously coded apps available for download from rogue app stores, that's easy enough, right? With the malware installed on your mobile phone, the gyroscope within the phone is now sensitive enough to pick up slight vibrations. The malware in this case, researchers say, can also pick up minute air vibrations, including those produced by human speech. Google's Android operating system allows movements from the sensors to be read at 200 hertz, or 200 cycles per second. Most human voices range from 80 to 250 hertz. That means the sensor can pick up a significant portion of those voices. Researchers even built a custom speech recognition program designed to interpret the 80 to 250 hertz signals further. Qui found something similar within the VoIP phones and printers. He found that the fine pins sticking out of just about any microchip within any embedded device today could be made to oscillate in unique sequences and therefore exfiltrate data over radio frequency, RF. This is what he calls a funtenna, and it is a virtual playground for would-be attackers. Officially, says security researcher Michael Osman, whom Qui credits for the idea, a funtenna is an antenna that was not intended by the designer of the system to be an antenna, particularly when used as an antenna by an attacker. Aside from a funtenna, what are some other ways people can spy on what you do at work? Researchers in Israel have found that ordinary cell phones can, with malware installed, be made to receive binary data from computers. And previously, Stanford researchers found that mobile phone sensors could intercept the sound of electronic emissions from a wireless keyboard. This builds on similar research conducted by scientists at MIT and Georgia Tech. Suffice it to say that everything you type or view or use in the office can be listened to in one way or another by a remote third party. For instance, say you use a wireless keyboard. The wireless radio signal sent from the keyboard to the laptop or desktop PC can be intercepted. Security researcher Sami Kamkar developed something called Key Sweeper that's designed to do just that, a disguised USB charger that wirelessly and passively looks for, decrypts, logs, and reports back over GSM all keystrokes from any Microsoft wireless keyboard in the vicinity. We've discussed the danger of using bogus hotspots at cafes and airports. The same can be true in offices. Someone in your office may set up a wireless hotspot, and your device might automatically connect to it. IT departments typically scan for such devices, but sometimes they don't. A modern equivalent of bringing your own hotspot to the office is bringing your own cellular connection. Femtocells are small devices available from your mobile carrier. They're designed to boost cellular connections within a home or office where the signal might be weak. They are not without privacy risks. First of all, because femtocells are base stations for cellular communication, your mobile device will often connect to them without informing you. Think about that. In the United States, law enforcement uses something called a stingray, also known as an IMSI catcher, a cell site simulator. Additionally, there are triggerfish, wolfpack, gossamer, and swamp box. Though the technologies vary, these devices basically all act like a femtocell without the cellular connection. They're designed to collect the internal mobile subscriber identity, or IMSI, from your cellular phone. Their use in the United States is significantly behind that of Europe. For now, IMSI catchers are used at large social protests, for example, to help law enforcement identify who was at the assembly. Presumably, the organizers will be on their phones coordinating events. After a protracted legal battle, the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California obtained documents from the government detailing how it goes about using Stingray. For example, Law enforcement agents are told to obtain a pen register or a trap and trace court order. Pen registers have been used to obtain phone numbers, a record of digits dialed on a phone. Trap and trace technology has been used to collect information about received calls. In addition, law enforcement can, with a warrant, legally obtain the voice recording of a phone call or the text of an email. According to Wired, the documents received by the ACLU state that the devices may be capable of intercepting the contents of communications and, therefore, such devices must be configured to disable the interception function unless interceptions have been authorized by a Title III order. A Title III order allows for real-time interception of communication. Let's say you're not under surveillance by law enforcement. Let's say you're in an office that is highly regulated, for example, at a public utility. Someone may install a femtocell to allow personal communications outside the utility's normal call logging system. The danger is that the coworker with the modified femtocell at his or her desk could perform a man-in-the-middle attack, and he or she could also listen in on your calls or intercept your texts. In a demonstration at Black Hat USA 2013, researchers were able to capture voice calls, SMS text messages, and even web traffic from volunteers in the audience on their Verizon femtocells. The vulnerability in Verizon-issued femtocells had already been patched, but the researchers wanted to show companies that they should avoid using them anyway. Some versions of Android will inform you when you switch cellular networks. iPhones will not. Your phone will associate to a femtocell without your knowledge, explained researcher Doug DePerry. This is not like Wi-Fi. You do not have a choice. One company, Pony Express, produces a device called Pun Pulse that identifies femtocells and even IMSI catchers such as Stingray. It gives companies the ability to monitor cellular networks around them. Tools like these, which detect the full spectrum of potential cellular threats, were once bought largely by the government, but not anymore. As user-friendly as it is, Skype is not the friendliest when it comes to privacy. According to Edward Snowden, whose revelations were first published in The Guardian, Microsoft worked with the NSA to make sure that Skype conversations could be intercepted and monitored. One document boasts that an NSA program known as PRISM monitors Skype video, among other communications services. The audio portions of these sessions have been processed correctly all along, but without the accompanying video. Now, analysts will have the complete picture, The Guardian wrote. In March of 2013, a computer science graduate student at the University of New Mexico found that Tom Skype, a Chinese version of Skype created through a collaboration between Microsoft and the Chinese company Tom Group, uploads keyword lists to every Skype user's machine. Because in China there are words and phrases you are not permitted to search for online, including Tiananmen Square. Tom Skype also sends the Chinese government the account holder's username, the time and date of transmission, and information about whether the message was sent or received by the user. Researchers have found that even very high-end video conferencing systems, the expensive kind, not Skype, can be compromised by man-in-the-middle attacks. That means the signal is routed through someone else before it arrives at your end. The same is true with audio conferences. Unless the moderator has a list of numbers that have dialed in, and unless he has asked to verify any questionable numbers, say area codes outside the United States, there is no way to prove or determine whether an uninvited party has joined. The moderator should call out any new arrivals, and if they fail to identify themselves, hang up and use a second conference call number instead. Say your office has spent big bucks and bought a really expensive video conferencing system. You'd think it would be more secure than a consumer-grade system, but you'd be wrong. In looking at these high-end systems, researcher H.D. Moore found that almost all of them default to auto-answer incoming video calls. That makes sense. You set a meeting for 10 o'clock a.m. and you want participants to dial in. However, it also means that at some other time of day, anyone who knows that number could dial in and, well, literally, take a peek at your office. The popularity of video conferencing systems among the venture capital and finance industries leads to a small pool of incredibly high-value targets for any attacker intent on industrial espionage or obtaining an unfair business advantage, Moore wrote. How hard is it to find these systems? Conferencing systems use a unique H.323 protocol. So, Moore looked at a sliver of the internet and identified 250,000 systems using that protocol. He estimates from that number that fewer than 5,000 of these were configured to auto-answer, a small percentage of the whole, but still a very large number by itself, and that's not counting the rest of the internet. What can an attacker learn from hacking such a system? The conferencing system camera is under the control of the user, so a remote attacker could tilt it up, down, left, or right. In most cases, the camera does not have a red light to indicate that it's on, so unless you are watching the camera, you might not be aware that someone has moved it. The camera can also zoom in. Moore said his research team was able to read a 6-digit password posted on a wall 20 feet from the camera. They could also read email on a user's screen across the room. Next time you're at the office, consider what can be seen from the video conferencing camera. Perhaps the department's organizational chart is on the wall. Perhaps your desktop screen faces the conference room. Perhaps pictures of your kids and spouse are visible as well. That's what a remote attacker could see and possibly use against your company or even you personally. Some system vendors are aware of this issue. Polycom, for example, provides a multi-page hardening security strengthening guide, even limiting the repositioning of the camera. However, IT staffers don't usually have the time to follow guidelines like these, and they often don't even deem security a concern. There are thousands of conferencing systems on the internet with default settings enabled. The researchers also discovered that corporate firewalls don't know how to handle the H.323 protocol. They suggest giving the device a public internet address and setting a rule for it within the corporate firewall. The biggest risk is that many of the administration consoles for these conferencing systems have little or no security built in. In one example, Moore and his team were able to access a law firm's system, which contained an address book entry for the boardroom of a well-known investment bank. The researchers had purchased a used video conferencing device from eBay, and when it arrived, its hard drive still had old data on it, including the address book, which listed dozens of private numbers, many of which were configured to auto-answer incoming calls from the internet at large. As with old printers and copy machines, if it has a hard drive, you need to securely wipe the data from it before you sell it or donate it. Sometimes at work, we are tasked with collaborating on a project with a colleague who may be halfway across the planet. Files can be shared back and forth over corporate email, but sometimes they're so large that email systems will simply balk and not accept them as attachments. Increasingly, people have been using file sharing services to send large files back and forth. How secure are these cloud-based services? It varies. The four big players, Apple's iCloud, Google Drive, Microsoft's OneDrive, formerly SkyDrive, and Dropbox, all provide two-step verification. That means you will receive an out-of-band text on your mobile device containing an access code to confirm your identity. And while all four services encrypt the data while it is in transit, you must, if you don't want the company or the NSA to read it, encrypt the data before you send it. There the similarities end. Two-factor authentication is important, but I can still bypass this by hijacking unused accounts. For example, I recently did a pen test where the client added Google's 2FA to their VPN website using publicly available tools. The way I was able to get in was by obtaining the Active Directory login credentials for a user who didn't sign up to use the VPN portal. Since I was the first to log into the VPN service, I was prompted to set up 2FA using Google Authenticator. If the employee never accesses the service himself, then the attacker will have continued access. For data at rest, Dropbox uses 256-bit AES encryption, which is pretty strong. However, It retains the keys, which could lead to unauthorized access by Dropbox or law enforcement. Google Drive and iCloud use a considerably weaker 128-bit encryption for data at rest. The concern here is that the data could potentially be decrypted by strong computational force. Microsoft OneDrive doesn't bother with encryption, which leads one to suspect that this was by design, perhaps at the urging of some governments. Google Drive has introduced a new Information Rights Management, IRM, feature. In addition to the documents, spreadsheets, and presentations created within Google Docs, Google Drive now accepts PDF and other file formats as well. Useful features include the ability to disable the download, print and copy capabilities for commenters and viewers. You can also prevent anyone from adding additional people to a shared file. Of course, these management features are only available to file owners. That means if someone has invited you to share a file, that person has to set the privacy restrictions, not you. Microsoft has also introduced a unique per-file encryption feature, which is what it sounds like, a feature that encrypts each individual file with its own key. If one key is compromised, only that individual file will be affected rather than the whole archive. But this is not the default, so users will have to get in the habit of encrypting each file themselves. Which seems like a good recommendation overall. Employees and users in general should get used to encrypting data before it gets sent to the cloud. That way, you retain control of the keys. If a government agency comes knocking at the door of Apple, Google, Dropbox, or Microsoft, those companies won't be able to help. You'll have the individual keys. You could also choose to use the one cloud service provider that sets itself apart from the rest, Spider Oak, which offers the full benefits of cloud storage and sync capability, along with 100% data privacy. Spider Oak protects sensitive user data through two-factor password authentication and 256-bit AES encryption so that files and passwords stay private. Users can store and sync sensitive information with complete privacy because this cloud service has absolutely zero knowledge of passwords and data. But most users will continue to use other services at their own risk. People love the ease of grabbing data from the cloud, and so do law enforcement agencies. A huge concern about using the cloud is that your data does not have the same Fourth Amendment protections that it would have if it were stored in a desk drawer or even on your desktop computer. Law enforcement agencies are requesting cloud-based data with increasing and unsettling frequency. And they can obtain access with relative ease, since everything you upload online, whether to a web-based email service, Google Drive, or Shutterfly, goes to a server that belongs to the cloud service provider, not to you. The only true protection is to understand that anything you put up there can be accessed by somebody else, and to act accordingly by encrypting everything first.